For travelers, viewing great art is an essential way to connect with the world and to get a closer look at our past. When you learn how to appreciate art, I think you have a huge advantage in having a trip that's both fun and eye-opening. I spent 2 years producing a 6-hour mini-series on TV called Rick Steves' Art of Europe. It was designed to help you find new ways to see great art. You can look for it on your public television station. Ever since I first explored Europe unchaperoned, right out of high school more than 50 years ago, my friend Gene Openshaw has been my travel buddy. You probably heard Gene and I reminisce about our adventures on the hippie trail from Istanbul to Kathmandu. Gene is who I turn to help illuminate my own appreciation for the masterpieces of European art and architecture. He spearheaded the script for that Art of Europe series and also co-authors my European art guides. Gene's with us right now on Travel with Rick Steves to share the joy of encountering great art masterpieces in person.
Gene, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Gene, we've worked for 2 years on this project. Can you define it in just a sentence or something?
Yeah, it's the story of Europe and its people from prehistory to the present, illustrated with its greatest art, meaning statues, paintings, palaces, churches. So because it's a story, it's largely structured chronologically, but as you alluded to, it's also about geography. It's a travel show in a way, because we're going from place to place, different countries, seeing the art that's there, and the landscape that shaped the people that made this art.
It is so powerful to think that we want to get a lot out of our sightseeing. And it's your responsibility as a traveler to take something with you so you can better appreciate your sightseeing. And an appreciation of wine, great. An appreciation of cuisine or a knowledge of architecture or geology or flora and fauna, that all helps.
Yeah.
Art. And in my humble opinion, art is more important than all of those things I just mentioned put together. I don't care about indigenous stones. Is that a word, indigenous stones? Indignant stones.
Indignant stones, yeah.
I care about a marble statue done 500 years ago that celebrated humanism, which is a big break as mankind was stepping out of the Middle Ages.
Yeah, art is food for the soul.
Amen. And we had 6 hours our challenge was to combine it into 6 hours in a cohesive story into a sweep.
Yeah, and I'd like to say we did it in a pretty coherent way. It kind of tells the story historically, but we take time to add in little sidebars here and there to deep dive into a particular artist, you know, the life of Van Gogh, and how you can see the life of Van Gogh through his art, from his early paintings of peasants to the time where he was his religious calling to the time where he, you know, the last painting before he killed himself.
And Gene, I'm so thankful for your writing ability when it comes to our teaching agenda as tour guides and art enthusiasts. And even Van Gogh, when you think about that, you wrote something about Van Gogh that really reminded us that if we understand the context of art history, it's much easier to appreciate a particular artist. Do you remember the line? You wrote a lot of words, but Van Gogh painted this like and this like Monet, and this like
he was like a sponge. He was largely self-taught, and so he learned to paint impressionism like Monet. He learned to paint still lifes
like Cezanne.
He added bright color like Gauguin, and he could put all of those together in a way that expressed himself perfectly. Ultimately, he could paint self-portraits like nobody else.
And then you look at that self-portrait and you realize he's coming out of this rich soil of the artistic community in Europe. These guys were like musicians that jammed together in a lot of ways.
They knew each other.
And even if they didn't know each other, they knew, it was as if they virtually knew each other, even if they didn't live at the same time. They slept with each other's art.
They loved each other's art. They hung out together in the cafes. Van Gogh knew Toulouse-Lautrec, he knew Gauguin.
And these guys were sort of the fringe of society a lot of times. It wasn't a pretty part of the world.
These were the rebels, which was kind of new for art, because before that, art was always for the academics. And suddenly you get this new generation, the Impressionists and the Post-Impressionists, who sort of set the template for modern artists, which is rebelling against the system in order to express your individual soul.
And we're talking about one generation in the 4,000-year sweep of European art history. And we tried to write it together in a 90-page script, both broken into 6 hours, one-hour shows. And what we were just discussing there, that was just a beautiful little conversation.
Chapter.
That's a little moment. And you lace all these moments together, and it does have a flow. It has a beautiful flow. I mean, I always think even... if you think about what powers people, where are they at? Are they cerebral or are they emotional? And I always feel like there's a pendulum, swings back and forth. In so many ways, history is like a pendulum. And for art, to me, Gothic is kind of, it's the age of faith, it's emotional. And then the reaction or the stepping out of that was Renaissance. And of course, that's more cerebral. And then Renaissance went too far, and what happens?
And it becomes the overripe Baroque style.
And that's emotional. That's melodramatic.
Emotional, melodramatic, the style of kings and popes. And then what happens there? The pendulum swings
again. They cut off the king's head,
yeah.
And they have neoclassical art, and everything is, churches are turned into temples of reason.
Yeah.
So this back and forth, and we don't know that going into this. We can discover that as we swim through all the beautiful story of all these artistic movements and everything.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. I'm talking with Gene Openshaw. We're reviewing some thoughts that came to us as we were busy for the last couple of years writing our new series, Rick Steves' Art of Europe, a six-hour miniseries airing across the United States on public television. I've just got a game here, Gene. I want to just do this. I've got some words that I tend to use a lot, and we want to use them sparingly. You don't want to call everything exquisite, but some things truly are exquisite, so you don't want to waste your exquisite word. If you're going to describe something as exquisite, what would that be in your mind?
A piece of art, you mean?
Yeah.
Let's say it's the myth of Cupid and Psyche, and it's this statue by Canova, where their limbs are intertwined, they're the two lovers, and then at the very center of the composition is that tiny little space, about 2 inches, that's the space between their lips as they're just about to go in for a kiss.
Gee.
That sounds exquisite to me.
That is exquisite. And, you know, it's funny that I didn't know that was a special piece of art for you, because when I go to the Louvre, and because of the work I do, I have to go to the Louvre, I get to go to the Louvre a lot, for some reason, the last piece of art I see is Canova's Psyche, and what's it called?
Cupid and Psyche.
Cupid and Psyche,
yeah.
Right after Michelangelo's Slaves.
Yeah.
And it is that, it's that electric zone, the air between the marble, that is like the center of the statue.
You're right, and it is. It's like electric, just like Michelangelo's touching fingers on the creation of man.
The fun thing about this is you don't need to have this dictated to you in a classroom. You can immerse yourself in the art thoughtfully, and you can come up with these ideas that just, I always use the word carbonate, that carbonates the experience. Okay, here's another word, Gene. Symbolic. Symbolism.
Symbolism. How about, instead of medieval symbolism, how about surrealism, like Dali or Magritte, where you're seeing these odd images, like Magritte is always painting bowler hats and clouds, and Dali is putting in these weird images in there, and because it's surreal, you have to make the connections and find your own meaning between these randomly placed symbols.
Huh. Maybe they're on a crusade. Another word might be juxtaposition.
There you go.
They're on a crusade to just mess up your juxtapositions.
Rewire your brain.
And if you try to figure it out too logically, you can explode. But if you can just go with it, it's kind of a freedom. What about bombastic?
Bombastic. Oh, let's say Versailles, the Palace of Versailles. It's 3,000 acres
over
crying
the top.
Out loud. Over the top.
They had a gondola in their pond out back. Let's go for a gondola ride. Bewitching.
Bewitching. I would say, you know Alphonse Mucha, who did those Art Nouveau maidens?
Oh, yeah.
Those beautiful willowy maidens with the flowing hair.
Willowy, nubile.
Nubile, and the hair intertwines with the flowery background. I would call them bewitching.
How about slice of life? We like to use that word, slice of life.
Slice of life. How about, how about Jan Steen, who does those scenes of Dutch families? You know those? And you see them just gathered around the kitchen table, and they're eating and drinking and talking to each other.
He's kind of, to me, an example of that new kind of market where you don't have big rich nobles and aristocrats and popes and kings and emperors paying for the art, but it's kind of merchant art. And I think by definition, it's affordable and small and not famous, but he's kind of the one famous guy in that genre. Here's another word, colossal.
Colossal. Oh, how about... a tomb, a prehistoric tomb outside of Dublin at Newgrange.
Oh, yeah.
5,000 years old, made of massive stones, 20-foot dome, all of this stone just to support one little tunnel inside where every day on the winter solstice.
So once a year on the solstice.
Once a year, a beam of light comes shining through that little tunnel and lights up the sacred chamber inside.
And they figured this out 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, and it works to this day.
It's wonderful. It's amazing.
And we don't know what power it was, but everybody who did it is gone. So maybe when that sun ray came in, it just zipped them away, and they lived happily ever after.
Gene Openshaw is back with us on Travel with Rick Steves as we focus on the timeless masterpieces we explore in the TV series we produced called Art of Europe. You can find more about Gene's work at geneopenshaw.com.
Boy, it's interesting to me, Gene, when we look at the Art of Europe, that the places with the most art are the places that had the biggest kings in so many ways.
Huh.
And, you know, those empires are gone now. Madrid's not that important today in political, you know, economic world. But there was a time when the most powerful and richest man in Europe ruled Spain from Madrid.
And there's a beautiful palace in there. And what he collected was some of the greatest art from all around Europe.
So when you are going to sightsee in Europe and look for art, and you wonder where's the art, you kind of think, well, who were the big emperors? You have one in Madrid, you had one in Paris, and you had one in Vienna. Today, great museums in each of those cities.
Great museums.
What are a couple of sites in Europe that you thought, that's a dimension of Europe's art I hadn't fully appreciated before, and I would recommend it more highly now after the work we did on this series?
What really strikes me is going to Europe is you can go and see the big icons, and they're important to see, but you can also see the more intimate side, the lesser known works. So, for example, if you go, you know, you're going to go, if you want to see something medieval, you know, see Notre Dame, and that's beautiful. But also remember that in the medieval period, you've got something like, you've got the Muslim world that was on the fringes in Spain. Go to the Alhambra. Look at the gardens and the fountains bubbling.
And if I could be a little bit candid with people, the medieval show was the 1 hour that we needed a little more razzle-dazzle visually, because it's more than just cathedrals. And thank goodness Europe had these fringes during what used to be called the Dark Ages that were just pizzazz. I mean, you got Byzantium coming into Venice and Ravenna with incredible mosaics. You got the Muslims, the Moors in Spain. I mean,
got the Vikings up in the north.
And the Vikings in the north. So that's a lot of Europe that was during a time that we kind of write off.
Kind of, they're sort of the back door. They're kind of forgotten. But that was part of what helped to keep that flickering flame of civilization alive during those 1,000 years of dark ages.
The formerly known as
dark.
As dark.
Period.
We're summarizing what we've learned about the greatest art in Europe, which I feature in the Rick Steves Art of Europe TV series. My longtime collaborator Gene Openshaw is our guest. The six-hour series has been airing on public TV, and you can stream episodes whenever you like from our website at ricksteves.com. Gene, when we think of our work as tour guides and so on and how that relates to the TV series we just produced, think of some magic moments that might help our listeners right now who are planning a trip. Of all the places we went, I mean, I'm thinking, for example, in Orkney, the Isle north of Scotland. That was a center of megalithic culture in its day. I didn't realize that until we went up there. And I walked into this tomb. It's a mound, a grassy mound with a stone tunnel that takes you into this chamber. And I bent down, and I'm not that limber, and I bent down to walk through this 20 yards long tunnel to get to this chamber. And as I bent down, I thought, for 5,000 years, people have been bending down just like me and probably not as stiff as me. And climbing into the middle of this tomb for 5,000 years, and we can do that today.
And you're experiencing the exact same experience that they went through back then.
So what's an experience that you'd like people to pay attention to?
For me, it's often the little tiny details of beauty that somebody might have caught, even, you know, back then, and that you can see now. Like a statue by Bernini, where you see a man's hand grabbing a woman's thigh, And you can actually see the indentation that his fingers make in this woman's thigh, and it's made out of marble. He makes this hard marble look like just small, just like supple flesh.
Oh,
that's one of those moments when you see it.
And you just go, wow.
And you go, wow.
And it takes a moment to get there. You don't just walk by it. You've got to ponder a piece of art. You've got to lavish your attention on it. And we can trace the evolution of our culture. One way to do that, I find, and it comes with magic moments, is domes. I talked about that first tomb from 5,000 years ago. We go to Mycenae, we see the Tholos tomb. And then I always love the thought of, what was the next biggest dome? Because the mark of a civilization's architectural sophistication is how much of a span can they do without any interior support. Can you think of domes? We know the Mycenaean tomb in Greece when we tour the Peloponnesian Peninsula. For centuries, that was the biggest dome.
And I would take you to Istanbul for what in its day was probably the most impressive dome ever made, in the Church of Hagia Sophia,
right,
which is now which is then a mosque and now a cultural center.
And that would go back to around the year 600, and huge dome.
Huge dome, in a way that would have wowed the people at the time.
It would have dwarfed the Pantheon, which was the biggest dome for 400 years before that. And then after Hagia Sophia, or Hagia Sophia, we got Brunelleschi's dome in Florence. And then, of course,
which inspired Michelangelo, who was from Florence, who then went to Rome and built the grandest dome in Italy, St. Peter's.
Now, for somebody to go to any one of those domes and to understand just the grandeur and the wonder of domes through the story of art history, that's one little thread. And together, I think we've been able to tie a bunch of threads together into what is a pretty cool tapestry. The more you dig into this, you realize this whole complex web of art and culture and progress.
One of the great things I think about this show that I enjoy the most is that we do step out from the chronological story long enough to follow the thread of one idea, whether it be domes or, for example, the evolution of statues in Greece,
mm-hmm.
From very stiff statues in the early days to the balance of the Golden Age, like the Venus de Milo, to the Hellenistic emotion, like the Winged Victory, and how that evolution of art styles mirrored the very evolution of Greek society.
You know, you and I both had, I think, similar professors. We nicknamed them Professor Stuffy Balding. In our very first writing, we got our introduction to art history from Professor Stuffy Balding. You and I have been for 50 years now trying to get that same joy across without the Stuffy.
And it's been a delicate balance because you want it to be historically accurate,
I'm thankful for Stuffy.
I am too. But if something happened in 1496 and something happened in 1504, we might just simplify and say, around 1500, this happened. And I'm hoping that that will resonate with the viewers.
And if we do it well, like wine, it'll be a very good friend.
And it's intoxicating.
Thank you, Gene. Great writing. I'm so thankful that we have public television to share our love of European art, that we have public radio to talk about it right now. Thanks a lot, Gene.
Great to be here, Rick.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington, by Tim Tatton, Kasmira Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Thanks to the BBC in London for their help this week. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Sheila Gerzoff handles affiliate promotions. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.